We return today to explore more about the highly fragmented factions that constitute the large organisation known as the Inquisition of the Imperium. We'll shortly learn about the origin of the Inquisition and the specific factions associated to this. But it's worth us also considering that as humanity has developed over the many millennia since the heresy, coupled with the ever-deepening spread of religious, faith-based worship, the Inquisition, which began its life as a group with a comparatively focused mission, has now, in the modern age of the Imperium, become a sprawling organisation whose core viewpoints are usually designated as being what's referred to as either Puritan or Radical. These designations are fairly straightforward and at a surface level self-explanatory. One leans toward the more pure ideals in pursuit of protecting the Imperium, the other more radical side leans more toward the highly questionable activities in all regards, but importantly they still believe they are working in the best interests of humanity. Puritans are viewed as essentially being more conservative in the sense that they believe inquisitorial doctrines should be strictly upheld, usually adamant that inquisitional rule of law be followed to the absolute letter, although some interpret this more strictly than others, both in terms of suspicion, judgment, and actions. Puritan inquisitors believe that all the enemies and evils of humanity should be kept at a distance and obviously purged at all opportunities. Puritans are more likely to be, but not exclusively, also younger inquisitors, and this is because they are still in some respects naive and yet to experience much of the galaxy. That is to say, still to become broken and jaded by its horrors. Puritans might be considered to be also somewhat idealistic to the true nature of the galaxy. You might say that they will not willingly scale their expectations as to what is reasonably possible for achieving within the constraints placed upon themselves and the limitations of humanity's place itself within the wider galaxy. Inquisitorial radicals are what you might consider to be more like the realists in one sense, and that's not really my personal perspective, it's just objectively one way of looking at them. They will see things much more from a very ruthless ends justifying the means perspective, and while that is undoubtedly a point of view that many inquisitors have, radicals will tend to take it through to an extreme level. Many are still part of the Imperium and will follow its doctrines, but others are just outright declared enemies of mankind and will be actively hunted. Radical inquisitors themselves walk a thin line of gradation between being seen to engage in what would be considered tolerable rule-bending and breaking through into outright heresy. An inquisitor understanding that they have become radical often only emerges having spent significant time in the service of the Imperium and have subsequently become either just frustrated with their inability to achieve their goals or have just become numb to the unrelenting darkness of the galaxy. Alternatively, they may simply have become unwittingly twisted and used by warp entities, believing themselves to formerly have held total domination over. Unfortunately, by the time they finally realise this is not the case and the reality of their predicament, they are left with no choice other than to accept their condemned fate as outcasts, forced then to live on the periphery of authorised inquisitional members. For most, if not all, radicals, it is likely that they will need to live thereafter in the shadows, constantly moving around the galaxy, in order to escape puritanical inquisitional judgment. Within their two core ideological schools of thought, there are of course many further overlapping sub-factions. In addition, there will also be many small cells of inquisitors who operate on a sliding scale of extremity, most likely deliberately out of sight so as to evade the detection, suspicion, and investigation of the wider Inquisition. Because of the overlapping and myriad nature of the Inquisition's factions, there may be some that I omit here and some that I summarise in brief, but that's usually because those are very small factions or that they simply do not have a goal that is especially interesting. Some Inquisitors' outlooks can in fact be fairly plain, tedious, or just irrelevant to wider ongoing events. Mostly though, as you will see, the overlap can become confusing, where one perspective sits within what is considered to be a Puritan view overall, but they seek to achieve it by radical means. It's a very blurry part of the Imperium, but perhaps that is very much part of its nature and origin. And when you're dealing with a very fractured, powerful organisation that tends to operate on a constantly evolving philosophical outlook, this is perhaps to be expected. Within the Puritans, the most recent to appear are the Amalathians, or the Amalathians. Their basic outlook is very uncomplicated, and it simply states that the Emperor has a grand vision of a plan, and that therefore all is well and good, that things are unfolding precisely as they should do because the Emperor knows all and sees all, and that it is by his will alone that we find ourselves where we are now. Essentially, everything is working just as intended. It may be fair but also harsh to say that the Amalathians are fairly boring comparative to the more involved perspectives of others within the Inquisition, and this is because they are more interested with the internal divisions and petty recriminations that occur as those who wield power within the Imperium fight, of course, always for more. The Amalathians believe that too much of this disruption is actually counterproductive to the agenda of the Emperor, and so maintaining what could be seen as the establishment within the societal unity of the Imperium, coupled with a strict adherence and enforcement to law and order, they aim to create stability. Their focus is upon this because they see that it was the Emperor's original design that through unity and discipline, the Imperium could overcome all obstacles or threats that it may face. It is only by maintaining a relative, and I emphasize the word relative, harmony within society coupled with mercilessly crushing disorder where and when it arises, do they hope to await the future for mankind as determined by the Emperor. The Amalathians are, along with the Thorians, one of the most numerous factions within the Inquisition. In this desire to create relative harmony, the Amalathians will impose strict edicts where necessary, and that will be backed up by proactive action if necessary. However, if given a choice, they will prefer to work with localized authorities to delegate responsibility and deal with any problems themselves in a more local way instead of stepping in and directly bringing down the hammer of justice against any dissidents, potentially grating then on a local population in the process. So they understand the need to kind of have a hands-off approach, step back. But of course, if necessary, they have absolute authority to escalate matters. But Amalathians understand that hearts and minds are important in not only resolving one matter, but preventing it from triggering another potential act of recrimination that will then have to be addressed. And this, also coupled with their intention to create unity within the worlds of humanity, is best achieved if they're able to resolve their own problems and not create basically like a cascade effect. In essence, Amalathians seek to carefully and with some attempt at tact, stamp out small fires where they're found, and importantly before they can catch hold and turn into burning infernos of disorder and anarchy. However, while the Amalathians may seem like the quintessential inquisitors, they are by relative measures fairly new, and even considered by some to be weak upstarts. There are those who consider them to hold wholly intransigent attitudes, and that their ideas are not worth any measure of serious consideration. It's a very simplistic outlook. This view of the Amalathians is usually held by those with far more grandiose objectives, like, for example, resurrectionists, who, unlike the Amalathians, have long been a core part of the Inquisition. So this contempt by opposing factions, coupled with them espousing what are usually considered to be extreme views and goals, mean that most conflicts tend to be initiated by Amalathians in something of a contradiction to their core principles. However, their abhorrence to those who seek to undermine all that the Amalathians believe mean that it is hardly surprising that they often respond with a violent reaction to those who would jeopardize their very identity and all that they believe in, basically anyone who seeks to compromise their worldview, and factions that would diminish them like this, for example, the Thorians. Now, I'll firstly say that there is a lot more detail in terms of connected cross-referenced events relative to the Thorians than most other Inquisitional factions, and this is namely because the Thorians are such a major part of the Inquisition. But obviously, if I integrated all of those references, this would be prohibitively long to discuss. But saying that, I sometimes do get the feeling that Thorian Inquisitional views are not well enough represented in what you might call the general view of the Inquisition. What I mean is that despite their overarching perspective being a major faction within the Inquisition, we usually see Inquisitors represented as either some form of, as I said previously, merciless galactic police force, very much owning the attitude of cross me and I'll kill you, and we'll come to those specific Inquisitors soon enough, or they're portrayed as the crazed Xenos hunters who would go to any lengths to destroy their enemy, primarily looking at Inquisitor Cryptman. Then, of course, you're left with the classic everybody's a heretic, let the Emperor sort them out stereotype. So this Inquisitor portrayal does give a crossover impression that makes you think of a certain megacity law enforcement officer who might say something along the lines of guilt and innocence being just a matter of timing. But these general stereotypical Inquisitors are why most people seem to commonly hold the perception that Inquisitors are merely extreme heresy hunters, which when you look at the far more fleshed out, nuanced characters who serve the Inquisition, like Gregor Eisenhorn, probably the best example, it's then that you realise how these more extreme caricatures do actually a great disservice to the real background of the Inquisition. And that brings us to talking about the background of the faction known as the Thorians. Now, I think personally the lack of discussion around Thorians' overarching views has everything to do with the fact that at its simplest, the Thorians' core ideology is heavily centered around bringing about the resurrection of the Emperor, aka that topic that shall not be discussed by any core narrative under any circumstance, lest it dangerously move our wider story incrementally forward in some dramatic way. But while it can be rightfully said that what is defined as the Thorian ideology was born out of the 36th millennium, it's also true to say that Thorians have existed in one form or another since the very beginning of the Inquisition. So it might be instead more accurate to say that as a faction they have merely grown in prominence and definition since the 36th millennium, but these are some unnecessary semantics that really will become clear soon. The Thorian ideology originates from the period at the end of the heresy when, of course, the Inquisition was being first established, except, of course, it was not then known as Thorianism at the time. However, we know that resurrectionist cults have been a thing for as long as the Inquisition has existed, and it's not hard to understand why. Those new members of the emerging Inquisition were those who were committed to most loyally serving the Emperor to carry out his will and who would hold a deep belief in his having a far-reaching plan for mankind. So it's very easy to understand why these individuals would certainly also want to believe that he was not truly dead and begin to muse philosophically about the possibility of his coming resurrection. In fact, they actively wanted to see this. As we know, the history of the Imperium and humanity is very clouded and very hazy, but it is said that there were originally four mortal individuals, trusted servants of the Emperor, during the building of his galactic empire, who in the catastrophic aftermath of the heresy and the Emperor's incarceration to a state of living death, gathered together to discuss what should now happen. These four were selected by the Regent of Terra, Malkador the Sigillite, to head up a new organization. The other eight were Astartes, who formed the Grey Knights. But the four mortals were divided in opinion as to how they should now proceed, with Malkador having been disintegrated, and the Emperor was interred upon the Golden Throne. Two of them believed that the fledgling Imperium could not survive without the Emperor to directly lead humanity, while the other two were adamant that the Emperor had ascended to a higher plane and that it would be sheer folly to interfere with the course of events as they had unfolded so far. However, it was also said that when the Senatorum Imperialis was convened on the first anniversary of the Emperor's ascension, a grim-faced man joined the council and identified himself as a representative of the Holy Order of the Emperor's Inquisition. This suggests that the early Inquisition was an amalgamation of several organizations and that they were established from the outset. But regardless of this, from what we know, two of the original four mortals, the founding members of the Inquisition, developed views known as resurrectionist. They are known only now to us as Promius and Moriana. They left Terra together so as to begin their quest of returning life to the Emperor, and the two who remained on Terra acted with haste to establish themselves within the newly formed Senatorum Imperialis. The two who remained were known to the Primarchs as very loyal servants, and collectively they began to lay the plans for the formation of an organization that would combat the efforts of the two dissidents who had sped off into the galaxy. These were some of the very first seeds that would be sown soon enough to develop into what we understand now as the Inquisition, but that would not officially happen until M32. Promius and Moriana were far from idle during this time, and they soon gathered together a following of their own, particularly drawn from cults and sects that were appearing on many worlds with an ever-increasing pace. And after the end of the heresy and the growth of the religious cults centered around the Emperor and his deification, somewhere along the line in this early period, Moriana and Promius split. Their overall goals were still the same, but Moriana had evidently become determined to use whatever means were necessary to achieve her aim of resurrecting the Emperor. So Moriana is perhaps the first vague concept of what would later become known as a radical Inquisitor. Fearful that Moriana would unleash unspeakable powers of chaos to achieve her goal, Promius created a small army of dedicated followers to combat the menace he believed that she posed. And these two factions would clash many times until Promius' disciples finally prevailed and Moriana disappeared, probably into the Eye of Terror. As the official Inquisition grew and its presence was felt further and further from Terra, it eventually came into contact with what were now known as the Promians. The original intent was to prevent the reincarnation of the Emperor, but this had been diluted over the centuries, and when the Promians were discovered fighting against an ill-specified chaos threat, they were brought into the fold of the Inquisition. Because by now, so much time had passed that neither the Inquisitors that contacted the sect nor the Promians themselves were really aware of the ironic nature of this cooperation, and so the organisation of the Inquisitors from Terra amalgamated a force that they had actually been designed to destroy, and consequently the first resurrectionist Inquisitional faction was then created. For nearly a millennia, the Promians continued on their quest, combating threats to the Emperor, whilst also subtly seeking a means by which he may be brought back to a mortal body. The research of the Promians rivaled the greatest libraries of the Imperium, but unlike a library, it lay dispersed across the galaxy like pieces of a puzzle, scattered throughout a wilderness. As the Imperium entered M33, the Inquisition boasted several thousand Inquisitors and hundreds of thousands of Inquisitorial agents, but in truth, this amounted to little more than individual bands of dedicated men and women pursuing what amounted to their own goals and initiatives, with little to no centralised organisation or focus. Unsurprisingly, this led to the seeds of heresy germinating once again. The Promians began to pursue a new philosophy. The great number of texts that had been compiled over the millennia by their predecessors was a growing body of information and contained concerning musings about the nature of Horus and his possession by Chaos. The Promians had begun to take greater note of these works in their goals, and subsequently a splinter philosophy began to form, known as fairly plainly the Horusians. In a textbook example of how blinkered Inquisitors can become unwittingly radicalised, they were now again in another ironic twist, continuing the original work of Moriana, who had once been their nemesis. They unashamedly explored the possibility of using the power of Chaos to restore the Emperor to a mortal form fit for his psychic presence. The nature of their works took them to some of the most uncharted areas of the galaxy, but unsurprisingly, especially around the Eye of Terror. And they would then grow in both number and influence. A few of what could still now be called true Promians remained horrified by these developments, but this was because only a handful of Promians had ever read the first teachings of Promius, or had been recruited by Inquisitors who had seen his works. But for those who had, they immediately recognised the hand of Moriana in the beliefs of the Horusians. The few Promians that remained did what they could to thwart the efforts of the Horusians, but by the end of M34, the Horusians had become a dominant part of the Inquisition's agenda. This is where a figure known as Stalia von Dressen would lead something of a crusade against these Horusians throughout the Imperium. She had spent significant time on Terra digging through the archives, and upon finding the Book of Promius, discovered the truth of the matter, that any concept of the resurrection of the Emperor was a lost cause, and an endeavour that was only considered achievable by either fools or heretics. She then engaged in a brutal crusade, and despite being aged at reportedly 120 years old, she all but destroyed the resurrectionist faction of the Inquisition. And there you may think would be the end of what could have been a major faction. But here things become somewhat more complicated and connect to what is known as the Age of Apostasy, and another event here known as the Reign of Blood through the actions of one Lord Vandyre. However, trust me when I say that I elect to save these for further discussion, as they could easily spiral out of control should I broach them at any length right now. But suffice to say, things became destabilised in the Imperium, especially Segmentum Solar, and this was related in part to the rise of the Ecclesiarchy. Now, some may question how it could be that the Inquisition could allow any major destructive events to occur, as by design they were very much meant to prevent such things from happening. Well, in essence, it boils down to an oversight in the importance of the Ministerium and the power it wielded, coupled also with a resurgence in pro-resurrectionism, and these were led by one Sebastian Thor. Now, Thor then enacted a crusade to crush this Vandyre, and after successfully doing so with the assistance of Astartes and Mechanicus, restored order to the Imperium. Sebastian Thor was requested by the High Lords of Terra to take the position as head of the Ministerium. However, Thor had no desire to take any such role, and his refusal was taken as being highly disrespectful and enraged the Lords of Terra. As a result, he was dragged back to Terra itself to face charges of being, of course, a traitor to the Imperium. However, ultimately, the Captain General of the Custodes himself, after a long trial, declared Thor to be acquitted on all charges, which was both a cause for mass celebration and simultaneously deeply humiliating for the High Lords of Terra. He was then offered the position by the Lords yet again, but his continued refusal only deepened their rage. Seeing these fracturing problems, this was causing the Captain General of the Custodes to actually speak up to Thor. Well known for their unrivaled negotiating skills and expert use of words, the Custodes convinced Thor to take up the position as head of the Ecclesiarchy for the greater good of the Imperium. But Thor had specific conditions, being that he essentially would rule the Ministerium as he saw fit and be allowed unrestricted travel. One of his major changes would be in dismantling the militant wing of the Ecclesiarchy as it stood then and replacing it with the Sororitas. Just an incidental aside for you, it's believed that the Necron Trazan the Infinite now owns the head of Thor, I guess because Trazan, heaven knows, he's obsessed with collecting his curious trophies and weird collections of mortal entities. Anyway, the Thorians. The result of all this disruption was the emergence of a faction of resurrectionists who took careful note of Thor's purity. Up to this point, they had been seeking any number of ways and vessels that the Emperor's spirit might inhabit, but upon seeing the nature and impact of Thor and that his faith in the Emperor could even create or quell warp storms, the resurrectionists concluded that they would focus their quest from here on in the saintly human vessels. They basically perceived Thor and any other saintly individuals as being imbued with the Emperor's spirit, and to them, this was evidence that their beliefs were confirmed, but that it would require a truly unique vessel for the Emperor himself to be reincarnated. So this then obviously leads us to the development of the Thorian faction of the Inquisition to develop what are known as the Principles of the God Incarnate. Sometime around the middle period of M40, one Inquisitor Helston, whose musings were based around compiled dissertations of several Thorian Inquisitors from the Tiberius Conclave. Though not widely known amongst even the Inquisition, these principles are said to be part of the very foundation of the Inquisition and its true overarching mission from beyond the visible and the obvious. However, the principles of the God Incarnate make the Thorians simultaneously some of the most Puritan, yet also heretical members of the Inquisition. And this is why I say the kind of strange overlapping contradictions that exist as part of the Inquisition are very, very strange. The reason being that their philosophy states that the Emperor is a god. That after the battle against Horus, the Emperor in fact does not live sitting atop a golden throne. He exists in the warp, in spiritual essence, and that he has risen to become the god of humanity. This is what they perceived by the Emperor's ability to reach out and imbue humans with some of his powers and seemingly affect events and situations across the Imperium. The Thorians understand that for chaos to be effective in the material world, it needs its worshippers, and it needs those who will carry out actions to enable it to be effective. They believe that the Ecclesiarchy and the Imperium are essentially this, but for the God Emperor. So their logic is that if the Emperor is a god and was once a man, but is now transcended into the warp, he theoretically should be able to transition from being a godlike spirit into a man once again. Hence they believe that they only need to find a vessel that can carry him to enable his reincarnation to become the God Incarnate. More disturbingly, if the Thorians' beliefs are in fact correct, then this would mean that other spiritual entities can also take physical form. They believe this is already the case for the Eldar, who are actively trying to enable this to happen so that they can defeat Slaanesh. And in fact, the Eldar already seemingly do this through the form of their avatars, although from what we understand about avatars, it's questionable if there is really any god taking physical form. It may simply be that the Eldar are in fact allowing their true internal powers themselves to burn through them. But most worrying, though, is if this were the case, it raises the prospect that the Chaos Gods themselves, who most believe are confined to the warp, could theoretically take physical form, if they were able to find a vessel to carry them, that is. But it's often said that when the Emperor fought Horus, he was unsure how much of Horus he was fighting, and how much he was simply fighting the Chaos Gods in the physical form of Horus. There are big problems with this concept, though. Not least that many within the Inquisition are concerned that if there were ever some form of resurrectionist event, what would happen to, say, the Astronomicon? What would humanity's reaction to having their god walking among them be? Would the Imperium indeed accept this, or would it tear itself apart yet again by civil war, as believers and unbelievers in the Second Coming turn upon each other? It's also unknown if the Emperor were in physical form, could he be killed again? If so, would he then be destroyed forever, exposing humanity nakedly to the great perils of the galaxy? What if simply in the action of resurrection itself, the Emperor were destroyed, if things went, say, badly wrong in that actual process? If somehow the divine avatar was unsuitable or became damaged, The problems and possibilities were limitless, and none could be easily answered at all. As a result, the significant body within the Inquisition would rather see things remain stable and as they are, in the belief that this is all part of the Emperor's grand plan and that things remain best left alone. That's when we come back to the Emalathians. So this has led to a situation where now in the Inquisition, little has changed since Promius and Morianna set out into the galaxy in their quest to resurrect the Emperor. Except that now some factions are trying to locate a suitably divine vessel for the Emperor to be resurrected. The parameters for that we have no way of knowing, and the others are actively hunting down such individuals and executing them as quickly as possible to prevent the other faction from even attempting such a thing. Now, I also want to note that some sub-factions of Thorians align with, as I said, a radical outlook because of their use of involvement with Xenos or the Warp, but I decided it's best to include all the Thorian factions in one set, including the Radical and the Puritan, together. So first up within the Thorian sub-factions are those like the Radical Horesians, who have fairly existed since the earliest days of resurrectionist beliefs. In the present time they are very few in number, and believe that the power gained by Horus is proof that there is the possibility for the creation of a divine avatar, and that moreover, the power Horus gained could serve itself as a process in transferring the Emperor to a physical body. So they conduct experiments, often using Astartes as a means to try and draw the power of Chaos and the Warp to better understand how this can happen, as it did with Horus. Some among them consider that if a body is possessed, it could be exercised and then leave a pure vessel able to be used. Despite their quite obviously dangerous beliefs, it is said that they usually walk this path quite wisely. Yet in saying this, there are those who become so caught up in their experiments and investigations of the Warp that they end up captured and twisted into doing the biddings of the Dark Powers themselves. Another faction within Thorianism are the Animolian Beholders. These are a Puritan faction and said to be among the most conservative of all the resurrectionist factions. This is because their goal is not to enable the second coming of the Emperor, but simply to observe humanity and await his arrival, which seems a little lackluster. They see it as their job to prepare for this momentous event and to stand ready to offer whatever assistance may be needed at this great time, but as a result the primary focus of the Animolian Beholders is locating potential divine avatars and then thoroughly just observing them. Only if they are convinced that the vessel is tainted would they destroy it. Much like the original Thorians, they are content to just examine and research remarkable individuals for signs of potential or corruption. They are more zealous than most in following up any signs of omens or existing possible divine avatars, and are amongst some of the most travelled inquisitors in the galaxy. But Animolian Beholders tend to be very pragmatic, down-to-earth individuals after a lifetime of seeking wisdom and enlightenment, only to have their hopes thwarted time and time again, tend to take a longer view of matters and, despite numerous setbacks to achieving their goals, are always very optimistic that the future may hold the answers. And this has garnered them a reputation for being very level-headed and reliable. Other inquisitors will happily overlook their foibles in return for these better qualities. The Ardentites are another Puritan subfaction of the Thorians, and although not truly being resurrectionists, they are probably still best placed to sit within that framework of understanding. And the reason for this is while they do not hold a solid belief in the basic principles of the Emperor Incarnate, they do not envision this as being something akin to a single divine avatar. Instead, the Ardentites feel it is more likely that the power of the God Emperor will manifest through a group of individuals, or more likely permeate through the entirety of mankind. Their rationale for this is that given humanity's evolution towards being a psychic race, evidenced by a gradual but very perceptible increase in mutation and psychic ability, it is the belief of the Ardentites that it was the ultimate plan of the Emperor to protect mankind during this very vulnerable stage of psychic development, that it was his aim to disseminate his powers throughout humanity. Because of this belief, the Ardentites spend the majority of their time attempting to locate any human expressing psychic ability. And this is a very vague, unsure process. None can say what defines evidence of the Emperor's presence, though certainly there is no accounts of miraculous events that might be accounted for by intervention of the Emperor. The Ardentites have become the focus of ridicule and derision by most of the Inquisition. This is largely because their beliefs and related actions have seemingly little constructive benefit. They've often been accused of dereliction of duty and wasting resources because they spend all their time wandering around and not really doing much of anything. However, it is this entrenched belief, despite all lack of evidence, that actually defines the Audentites and means that Inquisitors belonging to their faction tend to have an attitude more along the lines of, hey, we're just asking questions here. This attitude in defiance is almost a willful resistance to any logical arguments put toward them by other Inquisitors, and as a consequence they're widely regarded as basically kooks who just see the work of the Emperor being everywhere other than where it is actually needed and needed to be seen. With that said, their one other true virtue is their skills in investigation, as they dig into rumour and conspiracy far deeper and far longer than others. Regularly unwilling to make highly obvious conclusions from their discoveries, instead they will dig further to seek out inner meaning and hidden motives in what they encounter. And sometimes that can in and of itself be a highly beneficial thing for not just themselves, but the wider Inquisition and, of course, the Imperium. Next we have the Caesophilians, and these align with the Radicals, and their core view is based around the idea of a missionary saint during the early period of M41. A minister and member by the name of Caesophili had been preaching to feral worlds, but upon encountering some minions of chaos, he was forced to try and counter these incursions and laid down the foundations for an ecclesiarchy task force to follow on. However, as he moved from settlement to settlement preaching the word of the God Emperor, his foes began to take notice. Unable to bear such a threat to their power, the council of priests that ruled the world moved against him and had him captured and tortured to recant his errant beliefs. The chronicles of Caesophili tell of his arduous ordeal at the hands of the twisted priests to the point at which he died from his wounds. But 5 days after his death, the body of the missionary was to be burned upon a sacrificial pyre to the dark gods. And as the flames took hold of the tarred wood, Caesophili aroused himself and jumped from the fires. A miracle of this nature would ordinarily attract the attention of resurrectionist inquisitors like the Thorians, but the faction that have dedicated themselves to the study of Caesophili's story focus on one particular aspect of the saint's tale, that being the part where he relates his experiences over those 5 days where he lay dead. During this period, the saint tells of a bodiless floating sensation in a gulf of sound and colour. He writes a clamour of myriad voices, some whispering, others bellowing, swirled all around him. He speaks of a great light that suffused everything, which he believed was the Emperor. His resurrection to the Thorians is no amazing feat, because they believe this already to be an established fact. What intrigued specifically those who would become known as the Caesophilians was his description of a place within the warp where souls reside. The Caesophilians are specifically focused on learning and mastering the process of transitioning from the warp to the materium. They're experts in demonology and ritualistic summoning, but specifically doing this in a manner where they are the ones controlling the situation, not allowing whatever it is that they may summon to take control. This means that no accidents or malicious possessions should take place, because it is their hope and belief that by mastering the process of transition, they can successfully enable the Emperor's soul to be resurrected into a mortal form once again. The Caesophilians are also far more open to new ideas and information than some others within the Thorian faction, and will listen and even work closely with Inquisitors who hold different views to their own. Lastly, within the Thorian subfaction, we come to what are known as the Revivificators, which I don't want to say again, and they focus on the opposite perspective to the Caesophilians. They focus on the transition of the soul from the body in death to the warp. They study this in the goal of slowing this process, hoping even to halt it, and then to return the soul to a living body. Because of their nature of their studies, this unfortunately brings what I will now call the Revs into areas such as plague cities or worlds, the post-ruined horrors of battlefields, tombs, mausoleums, not to mention they're holding a level of disrespect towards the ecclesiarchy. Interestingly, as I mentioned earlier, resurrectionist views align quite strongly with the nature to which we understand the Eldar souls and spirits to operate, and I've talked at length in several videos now about how we understand the Eldar soul and their relationship with it and the warp, and how it's critical to understanding not only events like the War in Heaven, the current rise of the Inari and Ennead, but also potentially the birth of the new Eldar god and destruction of Slaanesh, and what this could mean for the Eldar and the wider galaxy. But much of this has to do with the way by which Eldar souls seem different to human souls. They appear to retain more individual integrity instead of human souls which seem to just bleed into the sea of the warp and are lost. This is why it is interesting to consider the Eldar soul not just in relation to their own culture's history and development, but what understanding of it could mean for humanity and the wider galaxy. So within the faction of the Thorians known as the Revs, the Revivifactors, they tend to agree with this. In fact, it is said that they have learned much from the capture of various Eldar over the centuries. In particular, they find the principle of the Eldar Spirit Stone very intriguing, and have on numerous occasions attempted to in fact replicate the practice of capturing a departing soul. So far, such attempts have proved wholly unsuccessful, for mankind's psychic technology is far inferior to the psychic engineering properties of Eldar Wraithbone. Although I will bother to mention, obviously Eldar Spirit Stones are not made of Wraithbone, they're entirely different, and they can in fact only be found now on Eldar Crone Worlds, which are very, very dangerous for them to visit because they're usually within Chaos territory. But they have also taken note in relation to the Drakari, the Dark Eldar's practice of soul leeching and soul theft, which have been noted by various data files compiled by Inquisitors. So some within this subfaction have gone so far as to try and even replicate the practices of the Dark Eldar, albeit on heretics or those of criminal persuasion. It would be fair to say that obviously these activities in the darkest dungeons of Inquisitorial cruisers or the depths of Hive cities are not exactly widely discussed or well documented. The ultimate goal of the Revs, though, is to be authorized to study the Golden Throne itself, which seems wildly unlikely to ever happen while the custodians still draw breath, and this is not to mention that their next aspiration is to perhaps alter the very working of the Golden Throne so that the Emperor's body might be restored. Again, the Revs study not only the passage of the soul from the deceased or dying to the warp, but also they have learned extensively about the process by which a corpse may be maintained in a state ready for reinfusion of the soul. Access to this knowledge and technology means that Revs often will live far, far longer than other Inquisitors, the oldest being Inquisitor Lord Verinath, who was shot and killed whilst strong and hearty at the fair age of 763. So it seems like there are some serious questions to be asked in that regard, as suddenly visions of the Drakari and their homunculi come flashing vividly to mind for some reason, and one may begin to wonder just how is it that a human was able to live for nearly a millennia, and just how were they drawing a life force to survive? Questions, questions, questions. So then we come to what you might say are the last of the core Puritan factions. These are of course the satirically extreme mono-dominant Inquisitors. And these are Inquisitors who would most likely exhibit the traits deemed most characteristic when people think of a stereotypical Inquisitor. That is to say, quick to judge, if in doubt assume heresy, exterminators, and remaining at all times absolutely merciless and uncompromising. As I have alluded to for a while, it is the monodominants who are very much the shoot you in the face first, ask questions or not later form of Inquisitor, and entertaining any thought that they may feel any guilt, empathy or conscience about their actions would be absurdly ignorant. No matter how appalling their actions, they feel no doubt, no hesitation, no regret. After all, their actions are duly the Emperor's will. In many ways, the monodominants are one of the purest distillations of the spirit that encompasses the 41st millennium, that is, absolute horror, unconscionable brutality, and not forgetting, of course, a soul-consuming xenophobia turned up to 11. Monodominants are the nightmare Inquisitors, who, all across the Empire of Humanity, senior figures, or indeed any in a position of authority, pray they never have to answer to. Likely because, 9 times out of 10, becoming the subject of their attentions will result in a speedy or traumatic death sentence. The monodominant belief system, and I use that term fairly loosely as it hardly really qualifies as a deep intellectual ideology, is essentially that humanity and broadly the Imperium are the only ones who should be allowed to exist in the galaxy, and that's pretty much the sum total of their perspective and ultimate goals. This very simplistic perspective of course means that subsequently any and all who are not human in the purest sense should be wholly exterminated wherever they're found, and obviously in as efficient and merciless fashion as possible. There's very little confusion when it comes to the outlook of monodominance, as there is little room for interpretation. It's quite a clear-cut ideology. This is why I feel it should only be a matter of time before a fleet of ships descend upon the world of the so-called Tau spheres and exterminatus their worlds back to the Hadean era. But I should not get sidetracked by wild fantasies. The origin story of the Monodominance begins around M33, when one Inquisitor Goldo described his theory of monodomination. This describes the nature of mankind just as it sounds, that humanity holds an inalienable right to not only rule, but dominate the galaxy. And of course it goes without saying that this is all in the Emperor's holy name, definitely not because some aging Inquisitor just decided it seemed like the best thing to do. Inquisitor Goldo compiled many experiences and commentaries from his nearly 400 years of service to the Imperium, and this time of service had brought him to declare a highly carefully studied, well-analysed, intricate and precise conclusion, which was of course that the only way the Emperor's loyal servants would survive would be if every other sentient life form were to be just exterminated. Inquisitor Goldo, it appears, was certainly not a man you would describe as one to do things by half measures. But as I said before, it's also just about as clear-cut as you can get, unlike some of the other more convoluted philosophies in the Imperium. When it comes to monodomination, there's very little room for subtle interpretation. Not when your final conclusion is basically kill anything that isn't human. It's fairly probable this is why later it would become so appealing within the Inquisition. But initially, when Goldo first put forward these views, it was not popular at all. In fact, on finally completing his carefully considered piece of work, his overtly pessimistic views found few sympathisers and were instead actually dismissed and attributed to Goldo being a very devout but aging Inquisitor who surely must have suffered something akin to a complete mental breakdown, clearly having lost all of his faith, and this is the critical part, in humanity's ability and power to prevail over its enemies at its own discretion. That's the important part, because essentially those who had a little more belief in the strength of humanity understood that it should not be necessary to wage these gigantic galactic genocides against the Xenos, because humanity was the most powerful force in the galaxy, and therefore would always prevail. What they were saying in effect was that the view of the monodominant were far from being an ideology of strength, they were in fact one of fear, of weakness, and that they did not align with those who were the true faithful servants of the Imperium, who knew that humanity could and would always be the dominant force in the galaxy. So Inquisitor Goldo's views seemed to suggest otherwise. Goldo feared and espoused the view that without truly extreme measures, humanity would likely at some point in the future fall into a deep chasm of darkness that it could never drag itself out of and be at the mercy of the Xenos. Except for the fact that that kind of contradicts the actual history of the Imperium and humanity, because it's already been demonstrated that humanity is able to drag itself out of that darkness several times over. But Goldo considered it was therefore necessary to ensure that those non-humans should be obliterated to as close to extinction as possible, so that this situation would never come to pass. Now, of course, we know ourselves that there is at least some truth to Goldo's vision of there being a potential catastrophe on the horizon with the potential to forever doom mankind. I won't bother to list them in any detail, you can take your pick at this point, but Tyranids, Necron, etc. But for those within the Imperium, his views were at best poorly received, many found them to be quite frankly deeply insulting and counter to everything that they believed. And so it would seem that the last rambling conclusions of a withered Inquisitor would simply be archived forever, lost amid billions, trillions of dusty tomes in an archive somewhere on some Imperial administrative world, most likely never to be read by anyone for millennia, if ever. And that likely would have been the case, were it not for the fact that several centuries later, one Inquisitor Jeremias would rediscover and subsequently feel invigorated by the views of Goldo. He would revive the outlook of monodominance, becoming, in fact, so taken with the ideals described that he swore to enact Goldo's vision. Since then, the monodominant viewpoint has grown ever more prevalent within the Inquisition, and of course accordingly within the citizenry of many worlds of the Imperium, and the followers of this ideology, not necessarily because they just agree with it, but because when an Inquisitor tells you what it is you should be doing and preaching, it's fairly normal for people to want to fall in line, as the consequences for not doing so are likely fairly severe. So these worlds, and indeed the empire of humanity throughout its history, have certainly held no great love for the Xenos. Most humans have seemed to be fairly satisfied simply to maintain, though, a more defensive posture, pushing back the enemy where it was found to resist the incursions of the alien, but beyond that, they saw no true need to, say, wage a war of complete and uncompromising extermination. This is due largely, as I said, to their overarching belief that humanity can always destroy their enemies, but perhaps it is also due to the fact that despite all the abject horrors that exist in the galaxy, despite the harrowing lives led by so many humans, there still somehow remained in the human spirit for the longest time still a sense that there was something entirely inhuman about waging a war of total genocidal annihilation, even against the Xenos, the enemy. Humanity had already learned to hate the Xenos over millennia of their incursions into their territory, but they knew that they could always repel them. The Monodominants have pushed that hatred to a whole new level, where nothing other than absolute annihilation will satisfy their desire for total domination. And even then, it is likely that they would turn their eyes toward humanity itself. Monodominant Inquisitors live purely to destroy all perceived enemies of the Emperor. But as noted, this perspective also extends, of course, beyond the Xenos, and it is seen most aggressively toward any who dare or question to take action against their views. Monodominants have almost zero tolerance for any kind of wayward behaviour, small or large, that is, in their eyes, absolutely no argument or answer that will excuse whatever they qualify as heresy, or even for that matter contemplating heresy. Most certainly not any action that is attributed to enabling or harbouring heretics. And that's even if you are entirely ignorant of it, or ignorant to your assistants there. They just deem that, again, to be an unacceptable excuse. Now, it should be fairly obvious, but I will note that for Monodominants, heresy is not limited to those who are just tainted by chaos and the war. It also broadly includes mutations, religious deviance, the high crime of being an alien, psychers, and essentially really any beings, sentient or otherwise, who do not really conform to their views of what qualifies as an acceptable imperial subject. There is only one punishment for what amounts to heresy in the Monodominant ideology. Unsurprisingly, it is death. In the view of the Monodominant, mankind is fighting a war not just to maintain territory or protect critical worlds, it fights for its very survival as a species at an absolutely fundamental level. It remains the Monodominant hope that if they're able to just kill enough aliens, psychers, mutants and heretics, eventually then natural selection will prevail and doom what little remains of the enemies of mankind to being a substandard genetic pool, creating a situation of slow, inevitable extinction, leaving humanity to retain its position of being the dominant galactic power, which is quite a bleak and harrowing worldview. Monodominants are, if it were not abundantly clear, extremely militant and will more readily resort to actions like Exterminatus far more than other Inquisitors. Where other factions might engage in careful investigation and subterfuge, trying to understand what is happening. Why has an incident taken place, and what might it mean for the wider sector, or perhaps have far deeper consequences? Monodominants are just far more blunt and simplistic in their approach. Usually they'll operate in plain sight, and in doing so, they rely upon a greatly feared reputation to stir up panic in a local citizenry. They will most often descend into then widespread xenophobia, hatred, just a very panicked and blaming citizenry, perhaps resulting in some kind of hive purge, thereby doing the Inquisitors' work for them without them even having to lift a finger. A frenzied citizenry will begin to just purge through their own ranks of the filthy, unclean heretics who may quite literally threaten their own future. Because if an Inquisitor were not satisfied with the status of a hive, it will be soon torn through by heretics seeking execution squads, or in a worst case scenario, maybe even Exterminatus. While they're more likely to do this than other Inquisitors, you shouldn't get the wrong idea and think that they're just obliterating planets left, right and centre. Calling Exterminatus is still an absolutely horrendous extreme action, and it's hard to call such an action without others noticing that. Although there are many, many worlds throughout the Imperium, Exterminatusing many planets is not the same as going into a hive city and purging sectors. People are going to notice those planets have become ashen wastes. And so engaging on a campaign of unwarranted Exterminatus is surely going to lead to that Inquisitor certainly being called before their peers, although it is fairly arguable could any punishment really be enough for overstepping the mark and obliterating even one planet of billions. Generally speaking, Monodominants are among the younger and more venomous members of the Inquisition. They travel very widely across the Imperium, often leaving paths of harrowing devastation in their wake, arguably being perhaps drunk on power. Yet it is also said that Monodominants also appeal with older Inquisitors who are very embittered, having seen years of unbearable suffering and horror. This can lead them to perceive that their other alternatives are wholly inadequate solutions toward the problem question of the enemies of mankind, and so instead resort to last-ditch blunt traumas which align best with the Monodominant ideology. For Monodominants, like many in the Inquisition, the confidence in their so-called philosophy is almost unshakable. This is likely a very vicious cycle of validation, as any who dare to question their viewpoint, this is only seen as a means and indeed mandate to commit more acts of wanton brutality toward the enemies of humanity. In truth, this is really little more than an excuse, which then digs their ideological hole a little deeper. But for many monodominant inquisitors, it seems likely that they're not able to really perceive this. Their views are so generally entrenched that they're unable to see anything else and are doomed into a cycle of abhorrent action and self-validation. Any challenge to the contrary will be automatically dismissed and only further deepen their views, making it harder to objectively see any other perspective or argument. So it is unfortunately because of this, to no surprise, that monodominance have become considerably problematic for the Inquisition and Imperium at all levels, not least of all because of their entrenched unshakable views. They're also the most likely faction of Inquisitors to actively engage other Inquisitors who demonstrate even a slightly less hardline view to their own. So essentially, unless you're visibly supporting them, you automatically must be their enemy. Somewhat unusually as well, monodominance often will not belong to any of the standard ordos. This is because they see the broad threat of the Xenos and general heresy in its most simplistic sense as being the highest threatening issue to hand. And again, it may also have something to do with the fact that a fairly vague cause determined by themselves is more favourable to enable their chosen action and continue to validate their perspectives than the more nuanced factional elements of the ordos. So while the monodominant philosophy has now become well established within the Inquisition, for likely obvious reasons that it's rampantly open to abuse, greatly is appealing to those with a desire to maximise and use their unquestionable authority and power. There's a very high number of Inquisitors who view monodominance to be incredibly narrow-minded and unconstructively rigid, and who will gladly describe that those with such views often actually cause a lot more harm than good for the Imperium with their excessive fear purges. It should of course go without saying as well that for those Inquisitors who believe humanity's future actually necessitates the incorporation and exploitation of alien technology, warp artifacts, and supposedly heretical notions, they also consider monodominance to be at best a wasted resource who wage never-ending, pointless crusades, when they in fact should be doing much more like the majority of the other Inquisitors, carrying out investigation to uncover secretive ancient technology, objects, powers that could best aid the wider goals for the Inquisition and humanity. These individuals, of course, the radical section of the Inquisition. Radical Inquisitors hold philosophical views that are really an endpoint for Inquisitors. It'd be very unusual for an Inquisitor to gravitate initially to radical views and then return to those of the Puritan, almost unheard of, in fact. In almost all instances, Inquisitors become radical, either unwittingly through manipulation of external forces coupled with their own poor judgment, by necessity, or because their long-serving experience has led them to conclude that it is the only viable path forward. As with any view, it is all matter of subjective perception to a degree. Some Inquisitors will be labelled radical by their peers and may perceive themselves still to be realists, relativists, or simply having revealed truths that others refuse to see. Whatever their perspective, all Inquisitors will believe that their actions are still in the best interests of the Imperium and humanity, and to that end, they know that it is their sworn duty to use whatever resources they can in the endless battle against the enemies of humanity. Some Inquisitors, like the Puritans, the Monodominants, for example, choose to see things relatively simplistically in a very stark, undeniable way, loyalist or heretic. But for other Inquisitors who are perhaps more seasoned, and realise that in actuality, few things like this are very clear-cut. They tend to see their task and their aims as being much more achievable through moral and ethical shades of grey. Those Inquisitors who find their views altering may not see this as an instant polarising snap shift, but more like a slow move away that is more readily manifested by slight disagreements in opinion between an Inquisitor and their acolytes, or if they were, say, cooperating with another Inquisitor. They may disagree on the most effective way to achieve resolution of their mission. When this kind of situation begins to deteriorate into, say, then bribery of a heretic, instead of turning them over to authorities to face appropriate punishment, then it begins to become more likely that an Inquisitor or at least some of their entourage have slipped from the Puritan path toward the radical. The usual trigger for the downward spiral into radicalism is a problem which has few options, but is absolutely critical to resolve. Inquisitors generally already have a bigger picture perspective than most, we know this. And so when you add in an ends justifying the means attitude, which again, many Inquisitors have, it's not hard to see when facing a dire threat and option A has a high chance of failure, but option B presents a high chance of success, except it means that you have to use some Xenos tech or reading a forbidden text, you can see how dependent on what stage of the service an Inquisitor is at, they may well think, that it's not such a big deal, and that the end result far more outweighs this small indiscretion than staying more subjectively pure. Except that, of course, this is the first step on the staircase to damnation. And the next thing you know, you're walking around with a richly bound demon of the warp offering you counsel, and your retinue is mainly criminals or mutants who just happen to be experts in their field. As with Puritans, there are many sub-factions of radicals, and we'll look through some of these today. I will note, as I mentioned earlier, that some factions that could be considered Puritan, like Thorians, will also contain radical sub-factions like the Horesians, and it can be the same also with the radical, but not quite so much. Now, within the Inquisition, sometimes these sub-factions or splinter cells are so small and fragmented from the normal order of things that it's difficult to know what, if anything, their actual agenda and ongoing objectives are. The Antiquati fit into this category. They're barely documented but are known to align more with the radical and are focused on discovering information, patterns and events within the past so as to be able to better predict the future. And this may not sound that radical, but it's the means and sources of that information that becomes problematic. One inquisitor of the Antiquati ideology was recorded as saying, "Knowledge endures. It awaits only the light of wisdom to craft it into the vessel of our very survival. It is the ultimate weapon." The Ocularians also fall into a similar vein as the Antiquati. In fact, obsessed with securing knowledge of the future, predictions, omens, and finding patterns of events, a belief in destiny, and above all, in keeping hold of their own secrets. The faction's detractors range in accusations that the Ocularians waste their attentions on meaningless and futile attempts to predict future threats to the Imperium while blithely ignoring present dangers, to attempted witch hunts raised by hardline Puritans against Ocularians who believe that they have courted damnation in their desire to know the unknowable. Ocularians are a sect whose provenance, exact origins and age are shrouded in a tangle of myth, apocryphal data and outright contradiction. Those few that know of the Ocularians in any detail consider them to be a paranoid faction of diviners and scholar inquisitors whose obsession with prophecy has long skirted outright heresy. Most curiously though, it is often the Ocularians who will emerge as the victor when drawn into conflict with their detractors, and this is very much to the shock of those fanatical hunters who have challenged them. In considering this, it seems that despite appearing very blinkered and tedious and scholarly and engaging in objectives that are just worthless in the grand scheme of things, the true nature of the Ocularians' power, their history and goals are far more subtle and terrible than even the most rabid witch hunter would have you otherwise dare to believe. It leaves them as something of an enigma, a worrying and very interesting faction within the Radical Inquisition. Istvanianism, by its name alone, should at least hint towards its perspective based on historical events, not entirely dissimilarly in some respect to monodominance, but they believe that mankind must be strong to survive and to do this by dominating the galaxy. Strength to the Istvanian, though, comes from conflict and suffering, basically war. It's that old adage that it's during the darkest hour that mankind shows its true and most powerful potential, essentially that we develop the most and increase the strength the most during periods of war. So in keeping with events of their name, it is believed by those within the Istvanian ideology that only passing through near destruction can the weaknesses of mankind be shed and then the strong prosper. This is obviously quite an extreme perspective, but these are the convictions of the Istvanians, beliefs for which its followers will willingly spend, with no hesitation, the lives of the Imperium's citizenry and soldiers. That means wars, misery, bloodshed, all in the name of furthering a distillation of mankind's strength, because without this, we must inevitably fail. That without such a sense of strength and sacrifice, humanity will eventually be beaten down by its enemies until finally it is again rendered extinct, or reduced to the point that it is effectively much the same. The radical contradiction comes from the fact that while this faction do not seek the destruction of humanity, its inquisitors will regularly sow the seeds of discord and conflict to ensure that they maintain this sense of unending adversity and strength through transformative conflict. The Istvanians believe that for humanity this is not anything unusual. In fact, they believe that it is the natural state of mankind to be in, and so there is nothing morally or ethically questionable about their actions. Essentially, it is that those within Istvanianism have convinced themselves of their need to continually manifest confrontation, and as a faction are a very strange contradiction in terms, wanting to both protect humanity, yet continually subjecting it to artificial conflict and disaster, which cost thousands if not millions of lives, mountains of resources, all in the effort of solving situations that need never have occurred in the first place. And so, just to make things absolutely clear, the Istvanian Inquisitors will actually create devastating conflicts that were not happening. They'll create artificial combat to ensure that a permanent state of war is existing within the Imperium. For this reason alone, they're considered extremely radical and very problematic. Now, then we come to the Polysicana. Now, they're a very interesting faction of radical inquisitor because there is a strong reason to believe that there is some considerable accuracy and merit in their beliefs. While they are only a minor faction, it is their belief that mankind is destined to evolve into a purely psychic race, and that the Inquisition's time would best be spent preparing for this transformation, planning as to how it can be facilitated and guided. The beliefs of the Polysicana Inquisitors are not unique. Such theories constantly boil beneath the surface of the Inquisition as a whole. Like most factions obsessed with the psychic ascension of mankind, they see this final evolution of humanity as being inevitable, so long as it is not directly prevented from occurring. So why are they seen as being radical? Because on the whole, this seems something that could be very much a Puritan perspective. Well, that comes from how they view the current status of the Inquisition. Polysicana have decided that those that are most likely to prevent the spread and rise of psychic powers are those who see the emergent undisciplined psyker as being an abomination to be cleansed. And who are those most dangerous to these psykers? Well, it is, of course, their fellow inquisitors. Polysicana inquisitors are primarily concerned with protecting psykers from their colleagues, and they will spend considerable resources watching for nascent psykers within a sector's population, and then extracting fledgling psykers to safety before others can burn them at the stake for what they are. Polysicana operatives also have poured energy into hastening the awakening of mankind to its psychic future by using eugenic techniques and developing powerful psyactive drugs. Something not strictly outlawed, but certainly frowned upon, depending on where you might find yourself. So the Polysicana, as I say, are certainly not strictly radical. They're more of a grey area, walking a line between Puritan and radical. But it is their willingness to engage other inquisitors, usually Puritan, that marks them out as leaning toward the radical. But as it goes in the grand scheme of things, when it comes to the radical factions, this is the most likely you would see in terms of that overlap. And the kind of overlap between the factions of Puritan and Radical, it doesn't happen very often, and in this situation, this is really the only time you're going to see that kind of blurring of the lines here. Librecaranism inquisitors grew from the Amalathian Puritan ideology. For the Librecar, it is not enough to preserve the institutions of the Imperium, but also necessary to ensure that those who rule and maintain them are ceaselessly watched, mercilessly judged, and made pure by bloodshed. To a follower of the Librecar doctrine, the sacred pattern of the Imperium as divinely ordained by the mind of the God Emperor has become weakened from within by petty political corruption, factional strife, and beset by arrogant ideology, not least of all within the Holy Ordos itself. Above all, they despise those proponents of change who presume to second-guess the will of the divine or betray their Emperor-given power and privilege for petty personal vice. For the Librecar, true order must be restored and tradition venerated, and the path to the sacred goal be made clear. And if they must take it into their own hands and become judge, jury, and executioner in order to show the way, then so be it. As we discussed earlier, many think that it is the monodominants who are the truly destructive inquisitors, but this is not objectively accurate. It is known that some Librecar inquisitors may engage in sector purges, encompassing hundreds of thousands of just plain executions, and that they may even revisit worlds to then carry out secondary purges, often committing again hundreds if not thousands of brutal executions on the most flimsy of pretexts, even mild insults aimed at the Imperium, Inquisition, or those representing these institutions. Worst of all, within the Librecar, when some of their inquisitors inevitably end up dead, they're likely to become a martyr, only furthering their unending cycle of objectively pointless slaughter. Recongregators believe that Imperial society has reached a dead end of stagnation and decay, which has robbed mankind of the means and the will to survive in a predatory universe. Which sounds pretty accurate, really, doesn't it? They believe that there is only one solution to such a danger, and that is to tear down the calcified monoliths of Imperial power and remake them anew so that mankind can survive. I think you can immediately start to see how a lot of Inquisitional factions are somewhat of a variation on a theme. Recongregators consider that it is the ancient bureaucracies, the forms of rules and governance, and thinning bloodlines of the ruling elite that are at this point irretrievable and so must be replaced so as to make mankind's future anew. The price for such change is terrible, but for an inquisitor of the recongregator philosophy, it is a price that must be paid, lest all fall into darkness and slow ruin. Their principal aim is to save the Imperium not from what threatens today, but from the oblivion into which it is blindly stumbling itself as a society. To recongregators, the threats that their fellow inquisitors see as most dangerous are lesser when compared to the greater danger of being crippled by stagnation and choked by mouthed tradition. Because stagnation of the Imperium is the paramount threat to mankind. Recongregators must adopt methods that are vile heresies to their Puritan peers. If the Imperium will not heal itself of its wasting sickness, then those with the vision, strength, and power must provide the medicine, no matter how bitter it may be. The philosophy and methodology of recongregators aligns with and simultaneously conflicts with those of many other factions within the Inquisition. Most obviously the group's opposition to stagnation and the belief that the Imperium is being strangled by blind tradition, this conflicts in every point with the Puritan Amalathian view. But if you consider the warmongering activities of the Istvanians, their creed of strength through conflict can somewhat align with the tenets of a recongregator. But beyond the use of anti-imperial organizations, violence, destabilization to achieve their ends, the two factions have a very fundamental difference. Recongregators want to change the current order and see it replaced by something new, whilst Istvanians wish to unleash mayhem with little thoughts of what is to come, as long as it's stronger than what came before. So as a result, many recongregators see the Istvanians as dangerous loose cannons and are just as likely to confront them as to make a common cause. But it should be obvious that fanatics who cleave to the monodominant or oblationist creeds see the recongregators as irredeemable heretics, traitors, whose only fitting reward can be an all-consuming pain and then death. So then we come to the Xanthites. Now, for the Xanthite Inquisitor, the warp and its inhabitants are things that should be constrained and controlled rather than denied. For the Xanthite, chaos is not an enemy that must be fought and defeated, but one that should be bound to humanity's will and, to go even further, put to use in the Imperium's service. This ideology was born out of the core belief that it is the Inquisitor's sacrosanct freedom to understand and even wield that which is forbidden in order to better combat it. So Xanthism remains perhaps the most insidious and most ominous of all doctrines, and the Xanthite movement itself arguably is the most ancient, powerful, and above all most dangerous of the Inquisition's radical factions. Indeed, to some, the words radical and Xanthite are in fact synonymous. When a Puritan Inquisitor ponders the Xanthite with their dark lore and darker secrets, they see an enemy 1,000 times more dangerous than any twisted mutant, debased heretic, or crazed psychic witch. Many other Inquisitors, Puritan or radical, consider the Xanthites to be walking along the edge of a precipice, arrogantly tampering with powers no mortal mind is actually capable of fully comprehending, and with that ignorance carries a potentially catastrophic consequence should they slip, but for a moment. However, despite the appalling dangers that Xanthites court, they remain one of the oldest and entrenched philosophies of the Inquisition. They include within their ranks a great many influential Inquisitors, as well as some of the most personally powerful individuals whose true strengths and mastery of the dark arts are seldom guessed at until they are angered or directly challenged. It is indeed a courageous or foolhardy Inquisitor that dares to challenge a true Xanthite directly and unaided, let alone a cabal of their number operating together with purpose. Any would consider to challenge the Xanthite creed must do so with caution, and it is far more often the case that several Inquisitors must make common cause to expose a Xanthite than they believe guilty of crossing the line into outright heresy. They must bring irrefutable proof before a full conclave in order to gain any relative and appropriate justice, and even then, the outcome can never be certain. At the core of the Xanthite ideology is the belief that chaos cannot be defeated in any absolute sense. This does hold some reasonable logic and demonstrates their understanding of just what the warp is. Because, as we understand it to be, it is a reflection of humanity itself and therefore must remain for as long as humanity does, in its current state anyway. However, they also believe that those energies and powers created by its existence should be used in the benefit of humanity, rather than left as an untamed hazard that preys seemingly at will upon the Imperium's lives and the souls of its people. So it is their perspective that rather than surrender to chaos or hide away in fear, Xanthism states that it must be marshalled and controlled, much in the same way that the mute energies of the warp are already harnessed by the Imperium to allow for interstellar travel, navigation, astrotelepathy, and in the manner that psychers are sanctioned and serve in order to benefit the human race. Essentially, their perspective is a very human one. Whatever exists that threatens us must be dominated and made to bend to our will. It must be corralled and constrained so as to be used however we see fit, for humanity is the rightful master of the galaxy. But some Xanthites will even go so far as to highly controversially speculate that this was perhaps the Emperor's plan all along. It's somewhat difficult to really make the case for this argument though, considering what has happened over the past 10 millennia. The Xanthite path is defined by three core concerns when it comes to all aspects of the warp, its manipulation and the power of chaos. Firstly, investigation, secondly, understanding, and third, its best application. Individual Xanthites can differ immensely in how they put these concerns into practice, also the lengths to which they will go to in service of their ultimate goal, harnessing the power of chaos and the seething energies of the warp for mankind. The first step of the Xanthite ethos, investigation, is a natural consequence of the Inquisitor's role and is given license by the power and authority of the Inquisitorial Rosette. This power and the fundamental strength of character are factors without which Xanthism would not be possible. The investigation of the Malefic is also perhaps the most obvious reason that Xanthites are drawn to involvement with the Ordo Malleus, even if it was not their first or lasting affiliation, as the combating of demonic incursions and the rooting out of chaos cults offers the Xanthite first-hand interaction with the forces of the war. It is then in the second step of understanding where many subtle dangers lie. When a Xanthite Inquisitor or their acolytes encounter malign forces, they prefer not to simply purge its presence, but also to learn and capture what they can from it. Chaos cults and warp incursions, their nature, powers and weapons are studied with a view to investing this knowledge into the Xanthites themselves where possible, destroying knowledge and artifacts only when completely necessary. Once these dark materials and lore are gathered and often paid for in blood, they must then be studied and measured, a project that can be as treacherous and as lethal as the fight to acquire them in the first place. And so, to aid them in this task, many Xanthites value building a strong and tightly knit organization of trusted acolytes and agents who share their vision and possess skills to use both on the battlefield and in the librarium. But some Xanthite Inquisitors will go much further than this, skirting the edge of true heresy by creating sects of their own or manipulating existing cults to aid them in the unraveling of ancient mysteries and the deciphering of arcane lore. It is in the final concern of application where the Xanthites' true power and the risk of destruction by fellow Inquisitors lies. The wielding of the warp's power is the final goal of the Xanthite doctrine, and it is not a risk to be shirked away from when the Xanthite Inquisitor and his forces are able to do so. As a result, many members of the Xanthite faction will use warp-tainted artifacts, demon weapons, books of chaos lore, and other heretical works as tools, employing, where possible, the powers and abilities that many facets of chaos can be controlled and tamed to the Emperor's will by the spiritually pure and strong of mind. Employing, where possible, the powers and abilities of these occult sources to combat the incursions of chaos, purge the heretic, and lay waste to the Xenos. It is the belief of the Xanthites that many facets of chaos can be controlled and tamed to the Emperor's will by the spiritually pure and strong of mind. Following this logic, some Xanthites will go so far as to practice the dark art of sorcery within their own self-imposed strictures and limitations, even instructing favoured acolytes into its use. This is perhaps the most dangerous extent of Xanthism, not only because of its practical risks, but because sorcery in any form is viewed by most Inquisitors, particularly outside the Malleus, as inherently corrupt and the mark of a chaos taint. Of all such sorceries, the most potent and infamous is the binding of demons and the creation of demon hosts to then serve the Xanthite. But because sorcery in any form is viewed by most Inquisitors, particularly outside the Malleus, as inherently corrupt and the mark of chaos taint, this is perhaps the most dangerous extent of Xanthism. Not only because of its practical risks, but because sorcery in any form is viewed by most Inquisitors, but particularly outside the Malleus, as inherently corrupt and being the mark of the chaos taint. Of all such sorceries, though, the most potent and infamous is the binding of demons and the creation of demon hosts to serve the Xanthite. Such activities, no matter how powerful a weapon it may place at the Inquisition's disposal, are those which the vast majority of Inquisitors, including the Ordo Malleus, see it as an entirely blasphemous and cardinal sin that only leads Xanthites down a path leading to the absolute depths of the darkest heresy. Within the Ordo Malleus, it is often said that to truly slay a Xanthite, you must first become one. Faenanites are a Xanthite splinter faction and are, it is said, reviled even by their fellow radicals. They have long been declared excommunicate traitoris by the Ordo Malleus, once thought utterly destroyed in more recent years. Unlike some radical factions whose existence is at least tacitly tolerated within the bounds by their peers in the Holy Ordos, the Faenanites stand out as a declared enemy of mankind. To harbour one of their number, even for an Inquisitor, is an inevitable death sentence. Cast out and persecuted for their unthinkable blasphemies and their unprincipled callousness toward the Imperium's citizenry, the renegade sect has been charged with breaking the commandments laid down during the Imperium's earliest days, and worst of all, they stand accused of turning their faces from the God Emperor's divinity. The fact of this faction's survival, despite the might of both the Holy Ordos and the Adeptus Mechanicus being turned against them, is a testament to their completely insidious nature and the crucible of dark power at their core. But just what governing force or intelligence first founded, and perhaps is still guiding, the Faenanites' actions remains unknown even to the High Councils of the Inquisition. So they're no mere group of shadowed conspirators and outlaws. Faenanism is an ideological doctrine. Its followers are truly fanatical, inquisitors, radical or otherwise, and by their very nature, they're usually of high conviction. And the Faenanite creed is centered on the mastery of the warp via technology, for a reason beyond the power that it may grant. Instead, it is for the future fate of all humanity. For those who find their way to it, the Faenanite path offers the only viable way that mankind can survive the horrors and growing threats that assail the Imperium on all sides. For them, the weapons and tools of the past and the comparative ideologies that would offer no more than a retreat into superstition and fear are antiquated and useless. They believe that this means we must harness the power of the warp and relative enslavement of the demon by use of arcane technological processes whose nature has been long forbidden to the Imperium. Their doctrine, which as an outgrowth of the Xanthite ethos, which focused on a technological method rather than an entirely occult one to achieve their goals, has mutated into something far worse, for they have also adopted some of the most extreme doctrines of monodomination. The Faenanites quickly cast aside the creed of both the God Emperor and the worship of Chaos, and instead came to the conviction that mankind's destiny lay as a fusion of man and machine, united and made immortal by the limitless and protean energies of the warp. If the Faenanites can be said to have any god at all, it is ambition, for they do not bend their knees to worship, but crave instead to be worshipped, to crush the cosmos beneath their heel and become lords of all that is or will be. The Faenanites see the Imperium reborn, not guarded by the Emperor of Man, but under their leadership, and see humanity shaped in their hands to become the ultimate masters of machine, flesh, matter, and spirit. In order for any of this to come to pass, the Faenanites know that the body politic of the Imperium must be decapitated and replaced, and the deluded slaves of the ruinous powers must be destroyed entirely to make way for their new order. Their extreme objectives have led them to gather the darkest of heretics and renegades to their hidden forces and pursue knowledge and malevolent invention unfettered by the stagnant and suffocating dictates of both Imperium and the ancient traditions of the Adeptus Mechanicus, nor do they subscribe to any restraints of morality and very likely sanity. In doing all of this, they have quickly built for themselves tools and weapons of incomprehensible power, and have unfortunately become so wild in their aspirations that many of these creations pose a great risk even to themselves. These weapons are made all the more dangerous by the Faenanites' beliefs and willpower, who would seek to use them without any sensible control or any of the subtlety that one might reasonably expect from other members of the Inquisition, which is really saying something. There is a great deal more to learn about the Faenanites, but this short overview should highlight why they are so rightfully declared absolute enemies of humanity, and that they are one of the absolutely most terrifying factions of the Inquisition. That is to say, if you could even with any sincerity call them an actual part of the Inquisition at this point, because ultimately, the very simplest way to express their belief is that they seek the destruction of the Imperium and to place themselves as the new force to lead mankind into the future. So then we come to what are known as the ablationists, and these are a fairly major radical faction. They are also perhaps the most stereotypical radical in terms of what most people understand to be a radical inquisitor. That is to say, they believe in the use of heretical and xenos tech, the annihilation of the self, and the subordination of relative free will. That is to say, they have accepted their fate as something more akin to being vessels necessary to defend humanity, and they have accepted the fact that they will be eternally damned by both friend and foe alike. They're a strange contradiction also, as in many respects, they could be considered still to be pure in their goals, yet they also exist very much as a damned and irredeemable individual. Ablationist inquisitors are consumed with vengeful wrath and fanatical certainty. They gather mysterious, often dangerous alien or warp-tainted artifacts and seek the most forbidden knowledge and wield the power of the warp, yet simultaneously and hypocritically have zero tolerance for any others to use such methods. Indeed, it is this intolerance of all other radicals that bears a considerable resemblance with several puritanical factions. Ablationists unsurprisingly consider that only they themselves may wield the weapons and knowledge of the enemy and still remain true in the service of the mighty God Emperor. Like most inquisitorial factions, this astronomic arrogance rarely allows for any level of criticism or objective rationalization, because those who have found themselves consumed by ablationist ideology believe it to the core and cannot allow for any possibility of that being questioned or proven otherwise, because then they themselves would be essentially completely lost. Ablationists are to no surprise entirely uncompromising and will offer heretics no second chance, no redemption, only judgment and death. This is obviously because their primary goals are to seek out the heretic, the witch, the demon, and to efficiently destroy such threats. And given that even knowing of the heretical methods the ablationists use could in itself cause corruption, their operations are carried out usually in secret, the heresy is consumed as if by an invisible inferno that leaves no trace of its passing, except the total destruction of an enemy of the Imperium. While they will have many physical tools, technology, and knowledge at their disposal, first and foremost, ablationists are masters of sorcery. This means binding demons and wielding warp-forged weapons against their enemies. These weapons and knowledge have been secured over many millennia, taken from the hands or minds of heretics, and are passed from one inquisitor to another. Ablationists, of course, will use more than just demon swords and tomes of dark lore to achieve their ends. Many will actually use heretics as their pawns or even unwitting servants. To the Inquisitor, these individuals are simply another form of blasphemous tool and will use them however they deem appropriate so as to most effectively perform their duty. Ultimately, they will still be judged and almost inevitably executed, successful as their living tool or not. I've often seen it said or questioned, how can the Imperium exist as it has done? Surely on the worlds of mankind, citizens would not tolerate such a dominant and brutal regime like that of the Imperium. And it's reasonable to ask, after decades or generations of subjugation, surely some worlds would fight back or find a leader who could attempt to do so. And the answer is very simply, they do. And this is one reason why the Inquisition exists, which leads us to an interesting tale regarding the origin of the ablationists, which was such a rebellion occurring. So in 738 M41 occurred the so-called War of Brass. It was to engulf the majority of the Calixus sector. Many hive worlds of the Gelmiro cluster fell into sedition following the charismatic leadership of a figure calling himself the Emperor of Brass, and thus debased themselves into worship of the ruinous powers. Heavily militarized, these renegades quickly sponsored and armed rebel groups on worlds throughout the sector. This is also a good example of why the Imperial Guard exists, because they're not always fighting the worst Xenos. They're often fighting against rebelling worlds of mankind as well, and maintaining order throughout the galaxy. And of course, this may often be the result of an inquisitional requisition. And so as they were counterattacked, these renegade groups revealed the hand of the dark forces drawn from the Eye of Terror in their number. So it was that over a period of some 5 years, the entire sector was dragged down into bloody warfare, and the Calixian Inquisition itself suffered heavy losses. But it was in the aftermath of this that the Calixian Conclave of Inquisitors became riven by schism and division within its own ranks. The chief advocates of Puritanism in the Calixian Conclave were shaken to their core by the excommunication and execution of Inquisitor Lord Godella Morn. Now, Morn was a noted monodominant who had based every endeavour of her long and distinguished career on unbending Puritanism and intolerance of any deviation or heresy wherever she found it. The event that was to trigger this crisis of belief was the discovery that Morn had been practicing sorcery and the malefic arts for centuries as a secret Xanthite of fearsome ability. It was revealed that she had made pacts with dark forces to grant her ever-increasing power, and her denunciation before a gathered conclave of Inquisitor lords drawn from across the Segmentum was extraordinary. Far from denying the accusations, Morn actually confessed that she had embraced the corruption of the warp and used the tools of Chaos, Xenos and the Heretics as her own. She also fiercely professed her belief in the tenets of monodomination. She was, she said, an ablationist. Rather than a fallen Xanthite as she had been accused, she had willingly damned herself so that she could act on her beliefs, in truth rather than in wishful dreaming, she said. So Inquisitor Lord Morn faced her excommunication and subsequent immediate execution by being immersed while still alive in molten brass. But it is said by witnesses she did so without displaying any sign of discomfort. The appalling heresy and death of Gudella Morn sent a shockwave through the Calixian conclave of Inquisitors, and all ranks could not comprehend how such a stalwart Puritan could countenance such a heretical doctrine as she had professed. But worse than this, many, after considerable reflection, came to the conclusion that Chaos is infinitely subtle, and its arts can claim the brightest and the most pure. They saw Morn's fall as an object lesson. But those radicals who observed the entire drama play out would secretly laugh and consider the inevitability that all Inquisitors would ultimately find themselves facing their radical philosophies in good time. Moreover, that Puritanism can only be indulged by those blind to the true war the Inquisition wages. So the story of Morn's fate and her professed beliefs would have a very profound effect on the remnant core of Puritans in the conclave, and was both very traumatic and transformative. Inquisitor Lord Morn had been of such complete dedication to her task that her words and actions could only be the product of madness. Yet Morn had also shown no sign of any madness. Quite the contrary, in fact. She had seemed very rational, very clear throughout her excommunication, and then went to the pyre willingly for her crimes. These inquisitors argued that if she was not mad, then her arguments and final testament must be rationally considered. And as they saw her consumed in molten fire, many faced the grim realization that she might be right. The choice they faced was between willful damnation and ineffectual idealism. In that moment, in the death of Inquisitor Lord Morn and her challenge to the paradox of Puritanism, the ablationist faction was born in fire, death, and sorrow. Though many will eventually embrace radicalism, few will ultimately prevail. Truly, it is said that the wages of sin are death, and this is never truer than in the case of one who takes such a path to its extreme. In the short term, many radicals find themselves handling great powers that they would never otherwise have come into the possession of, and this often leads to a belief that such knowledge should never have been declared forbidden. If it can imbue one with such immense power to use it against an enemy, then how can this be a bad thing? Soon enough, they'll come to regard their peers as deluded fools, and such hubris can only lead to open wars between inquisitors. Something that's regularly misunderstood is the meaning of the inquisitorial excommunication. This process is not exclusively focused on expelling other inquisitors, it is a far more severe and fundamental judgment than that. All inquisitors hold the power to declare any individual, organization, or even a whole planet as excommunicate traitoris. This declaration excommunicates the accused not simply from the Inquisition, but it actually marks them as having been disconnected from the human race. The judgment stands as an indication to other Inquisitors and Adepta that the excommunicate party should be hunted down and killed for the better security and well-being of the Imperium. Inquisitorial gatherings will often be the venue for declaring such excommunications. In extreme circumstances, Inquisitors, as we will know, can be excommunicated. But such a harsh and usually permanent judgment is never declared lightly, but it remains a principal weapon of the Inquisition, a powerful tool that they can wield to protect the Imperium. Most Inquisitors will be excommunicated because of radical activity, forcing them to live then an entirely different life from that point onward. It is long since observed that radicals will almost universally spiral out of control once they have undergone their dark awakening, and therefore it is usually only a matter of time before they become an unsalvageable, abhorrent parody of everything they once stood for. Puritans observe this to be much like a terminal illness from which none can really recover and for which no known cure will exist. They have become tainted, corrupted, and are just consequently lost. This is the stage at which an inquisitor will often then be denounced by their peers, and it need not be a fully independent inquisitor either. Acolytes may be cast adrift by their masters, but often not necessarily through fault of their own, but maybe ignorance and naivety, but these are not excuses for heresy. For any and all who stray from the path of the righteous, only one fate awaits them: excommunication. And yes, obviously death. I mean, that just goes without saying at this point. For those radicals who are lucky enough not to be captured during investigations, they who were once the hunters now become the hunted. Few safe harbours would want to welcome them, many more would actively engage them. They will lose significant access to resources and need to watch their backs ever more cautiously than before, for now they face not only the enemies of humanity, but much of humanity itself. Because of this, many inquisitors of a radical belief will stray quite literally from the light and are left to inhabit the shadowy depths of worlds to remain out of sight. They will continue their quests, of course, but will at every opportunity deceive and evade authorities who seek their extermination. Some, of course, are not so lucky, and when their corrupting actions are revealed, they may be in no position to resist their fellow inquisitors. After severe interrogations that can span weeks and utilize multiple experienced inquisitors to drain every last drop of knowledge from the radical, excommunication will inevitably follow if it has not done so already. The subject inquisitor or their followers will of course be summarily executed. In some instances, if an inquisitor were deemed to have not strayed far from the path or done significant damage, they may be granted a small reprieve in being processed for arcoflagellation, which you may argue is not much of a reprieve, but at least you will still serve the emperor and have some chance at redemption. Still, some inquisitors never know opportunity for any of this. Inquisitors like Sabathiel are just simply executed on the spot by, say, Astartes or Grey Knights, who, upon discovering a heretical inquisitor that has allowed themselves to be manipulated, will rarely hesitate in just carrying out an immediate execution. Unlike the inquisitors, they have no great desire or patience for any kind of drawn-out interrogation. The spacemans know that although they will have to answer for such an action, it is very unlikely that any negative recriminations will fall back upon them, especially if no one saw it happen in the chaotic and often harrowing midst of a battle. Now, as I noted previously in part 1, when you begin to understand how the Inquisition operates overall, you start to understand the reason as to why a great many things will remain hazy, unclear, actively clouded, and subject to interpretation. It all starts to make a lot more sense. The Inquisition, through its expansive ideological beliefs and factional differences, bring into focus one of the major problems facing the Imperium, which is on the one hand an individually strong belief in what is right and what must be done, and simultaneously a highly fractured, almost permanent state of civil war. It's often asked, will the Imperium ever face another civil war? I would argue that ever since the Horus Heresy, the Imperium has existed in some sense in a permanent state of a cold civil war, with periodic outbreaks of espionage, assassinations, and larger diplomatic incidents. When the definitions are often as simple as one's heretic is another's saviour, and that even those terms are poorly defined, it is inevitable that factional disagreements will spill out into wider problems. However, despite the Inquisition pulling the Imperium in different directions, it also remains by contradiction the thing which has also helped hold it together. Through its constant investigation, eradication of problems, and suppression of dangerous material, it has kept the Imperium, along with its institutions and bureaucracy, in an ever-permanent state of stagnation for 10,000 years. However, those days are ending. Events and individuals are beginning to tug at the threads of the Inquisitional ideology, and that is a very dangerous thing indeed. Until the modern age of the Imperium, the Inquisition has been able to be a part of the system which kept the fog of knowledge smothering humanity. Yet times are changing, and quickly. Threats are becoming more deadly, technological developments are being made. The question is, if a light is finally shone on those darker corners of the Inquisition, will those conclaves flee into the darkness, or, feeling cornered, turn and fight? Of course, in many ways, this has always been the case when it comes to those darker elements of the Inquisition. It's simply now that the pressures from those like Gilliman and Call could become ever more difficult to resist. But still, the galaxy is a big place, and there will always be places for inquisitional factions to re-establish themselves. One thing seems sure at this point in time. Many inquisitional factions are so embedded and entrenched in their beliefs that to remove them from the equation would require nothing short of complete eradication. No amount of evidence or rational argument is going to be able to change their opinions, short of perhaps the Emperor standing literally in front of them, speaking for himself, and for some, perhaps not even then. This absolute devotion is in fact likely true of most inquisitional factions. While they will share information and discuss with other inquisitors periodically, most of their beliefs are not purely based on logic and reason and tangible evidence. They can't, because by the very nature of the lives they live, a lot of faith is placed in assumptions and speculation. The Inquisition remains a very strange hybrid of what you might consider to be near-fanatical religious ideology, combined with ever more extreme factional validation of their own deciphered philosophical outlooks. Except that in saying all of this, the Inquisition remains a fascinating contradiction. In many ways, it poses one of the most severe threats to the Imperium. In fact, sometimes this is quite actively the case, with Inquisitors creating literal devastation, far worse than even the supposed enemies of humanity. But on the other hand, they are some of the most committed investigators in revealing the heretics, the Xenos threat to mankind, and exterminating them wherever they're found. It's this curious duality that makes the Inquisition one of the most interesting, but also one of the most terrifying factions within the Imperium of Man. To conclude this overview of the Inquisition, I'll venture one possibility. The prospect that the Thorian faction of the Inquisition may be shown to be correct in their ideological assumptions. That is to say, their devout belief in the by now mythical prophecies speaking to the Emperor's resurrection. Now, as is so often the case when it comes to human spiritualistic predictions, it is said within these Thorian beliefs that before the Emperor shall be resurrected, the galaxy shall enter into a prolonged period of great upheaval, strife, and war. Predicting humanity will enter such times seems not really much of a revelation though, given our history. But Thorian beliefs say that the Emperor's second coming will not only be during this period of upheaval, but also to be preceded by momentous events. This is again quite vague, obviously. However, many Inquisitors have unsurprisingly believed this to already be taking place throughout the final years of the 41st and now most certainly upon entering the 42nd millennium. They have witnessed the reawakening of the Necron, the ever-increasing danger the Tyranid threat presents to the entire galaxy. Orcs are often readily written off when stacked against those more spectacular threats facing mankind. But it's worth remembering that the Orcs have wrought terrible damage to the Imperium before now. They were almost at their most dangerous when humanity is in fact facing other distractions on all sides. Because if the Orcs see a weakness, make no mistake, they will most certainly exploit it. And allowing the Orc menace to gain momentum through unaddressed victories is an extremely unwise thing to allow at any time. Then add to this, humanity still has to contend with the ever-ongoing cavalier activities of the Eldar, who are obsessed with restoring themselves as the dominant force in the galaxy. Humanity sometimes mistakes, again, the Eldar as being something like an ally of convenience. But this is primarily because the Eldar have been slightly humbled by their crushing fall from grace. They've clung on to their existence by their fingernails, and now they look to turn their fate regardless of the consequences. Mankind would do well to remember that the Eldari are very arrogant, and they think only of their own glory, even if it comes at the expense of all others. Then, of course, there is the devastating tear in reality that now spans the entire galaxy, a gaping wound inflicted upon the Materium, dividing humanity's Imperium and allowing chaos to freely envelop worlds, stood close to the tear in real space, just as happened to those near the vicinity of the Eye of Terror. What was once described as a gated Eye of Terror, patrolled by both humanity and the Eldar, is now a shattered memory, and for those who know the stories and details of this time, there are those who might question just how well humanity held off against those heretics. That is to say, while it may be true that in their darkest hour they screamed into the void, Cadia stands, but was this entire debacle in fact simply a case of the Imperium's stagnant bureaucracy culminating in a highly visible, devastating failure for mankind? If only we were able to pore over the records of that time, who signed which orders, which reports were missed, how many patrols were reassigned or cancelled. It seems certain that the most relevant of which are by now undoubtedly destroyed, lost during the planet's catastrophic destruction. And then you have the ever-growing Necron threat, which we reveal new information about all the time. The activities of the Necron seem to align something to do with their previous actions during the war in heaven and their current reawakening, the return of the Silent King. More disturbingly, it's beginning to become clear that the actions of the Necron in terms of their wider plan for the galaxy, as they have perceived the huge threats out of their awakening period, have a significant possibility of dooming not just mankind, but the Emperor's vision for humanity. And you may think to yourself, well, if the Necron want to focus on destroying chaos, how can that be a bad thing for humanity? Well, as we have recently learned, their ability to use the Necron pylons, the Blackstone pylons, actually have an effect even on ordinary humans, because what you need to remember is that the Necron's use of Blackstone is a means to nullify psychic power. And you remember that humans, even down to your standard guardsmen, all retain some level of psychic activity, and the effect of a powerful nullification force is enough to affect even your standard human. The ongoing long-term consequences for humanity could be truly devastating. And this is something already that the Inquisition is hurriedly looking into, as we recently learned in the experiences of the Pariah Nexus. But until such events come to pass, the Thorians and many other Inquisitors continue to battle, either to prepare for or proactively enable the second coming of the Emperor. And they are of course threatened by those who espouse opposite opinions, and who simultaneously fight with every breath they can muster each day to prevent any such situation from ever coming to pass, believing such views to be extreme, dangerous, and highly flawed outlooks. The Inquisition, collectively encompassing their multitude of factions, continues unabated in their persistent quest to learn all they can about those dark, hidden fragments of humanity's and, where specifically applicable, Xenos knowledge. Unforeseen revelations may enthuse a cell of Inquisitors to make preparations for whatever newly speculated ideology they somehow adapt, find, or rationalise. But perhaps a means will be discovered to enable an Inquisition or faction to finally understand with definite clarity what awaits humanity in what is now seemingly its ever-darkening future. One constant remains, of course, which all Inquisitors can dutifully rely upon, that in the 42nd millennium for both humanity and the wider Imperium of mankind, there still remains only war.